Let's go.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Bingetown TV. This is Brian here with Luke, Paul, and producer Dave. And today we're going to be talking episodes 3 and 4 of Netflix's new show, The Sandman. And I mean, episode 3 and 4, I think for me, they are defined by the characters that we meet in these two episodes, being Matthew the Raven, legend in the making, Joanna Constantine, legend, we see it on the screen, and Lucifer, who is not what I was expecting. I knew Gwendolyn Christie was in this, but that she's just got a way about her, like an aura, and that character was doing it for me. But awesome episodes, in my opinion. I texted the group chat, said, yeah, we took a step up from episodes 1 and 2, which makes sense for a fantasy show like this. We get the exposition dump. Now we're getting into the meat of the story. And I've been talking for a while. So what do we think, guys?
I call next because Jesus Christ, I am as in as you could possibly be through 4 episodes of a show. Like, every single episode has gotten progressively better, in my opinion. And I still loved episode 1 as an opener. So that just says a lot about my opinion. I'm super biased already. This show, the hype train in my head, it's going off the rails. I love everything. I'm falling in love with Dream's performance. I think he's just so great at what he does. Like, he doesn't show emotion, but he still conveys a lot of emotion at the right time. And these new characters that get introduced, I think, well, if we were to do a character rankings, would definitely make my top 3, because I loved Joanna. She was amazing. Played by Jenna Coleman. She's been in other things like Captain America, The First Avengers. She's been in some random things, but she was awesome. And then, of course, I agree with what you said about Brienne of Tarth being amazing as Lucifer Morningstar.
Yeah, just to hop off what Luke was saying, these two were not, I'm not going to say so much better than episodes 1 and 2, but definitely cemented this as of just an excellent TV show. I've been absolutely loving the watch throughs. I feel like I'm just constantly like awing at certain events that happen in each episode. And it's just enough. They give you enough information to keep you interested while still giving you enough mystery that you just want to keep watching the episodes. It was definitely very hard at the end of 4 for me to not continue on with 5 with the cliffhanger that we got. But these two episodes were my favorite by far so far. And it's just, I can't believe that this show just has been under our radar. And now it's just, everyone in our chat's been blown up about it, and we're all super excited to be covering it on the podcast.
Under your radar.
Yeah, under my radar.
The old by far so far. You love to see it.
So by far so far, I am loving this. Like, it is, I mean, the world building is just insane, because there's so many realms. There's so many realms and so much to do that there's so much information to just tease us, and little conversations here and there. And they're just dropping names that, you know, might come back later in the season, maybe even more. It's just so cool. And I am totally in love with the actor who plays Dream. What's his name? Tommy Sturridge. Well, he's a beast, if that's correct. I got to double check that. But yeah, this is, I mean, absolutely,
yes,
insane.
It is correct.
Okay, cool. And I was a little hesitant with the introduction of Matthew the Raven. I was like, okay, is this like Patton Oswalt's the man? Don't get me wrong, the guy who voices him. Also the voice of the Deep Skills in season 2. A little,
yes,
tie in there.
Yes.
I was like a little nervous. I was like, do we really need this comedic relief in this like deep, dark, serious show? But he's fucking killing it so far. I really like him. And it's just setting up for a great finale.
I was not expecting Patton Oswalt to be the voice actor of the, I didn't even expect the bird to speak. And then when he did, I was like, one, it's great that he is able to talk. And two, it's great that it's Patton Oswalt. So,
and
yeah, go ahead.
We got some cool information, because we were talking about when Chesme died, how come she didn't go back into the dreaming? We actually got a little bit of information here. Apparently, Matthew was alive a few hours ago, died, and now he became a raven, and Lucienne just is telling him where to go. So just the fact that people, real like humans, die and then can transfer into ravens somehow, like, really cool.
By more information, you mean more variables that make it confusing, because I still,
yes,
don't really understand. But I get what you're saying.
I took away from that reincarnation is a thing in this universe, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. But it adds another layer of in like, way, is it yeah. always dreams realm that reincarnation happens into, or like, it, there's just, again, too many variables, not enough information. It would all just be guesswork by us right now.
The only thing I want to mention really quickly is Luke already gushed over Joanna. I'm going to gush over John. I thought his performance in this, aka Lupin from Harry Potter, aka David Thewlis. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but I think I fell in love with John as a villain like so easily when he broke out of the insane asylum. So we'll get there when we get there. But I just wanted to shout out his performance. He crushed it as an upcoming villain for me.
You guys ready to start into the episode? And we'll keep bringing up things that we liked and didn't like and, you know, all that good stuff.
Get it.
So episode 3, Dream a Little Dream of Me. And this is Joanna Constantine's her first appearance. We heard about her in the last episode from the Fates. And what we're going to cover in this first conversation is just her introduction, including her nightmare that she's been seeing all the way through her performing the satanic ritual to send the demon back to hell. And Dream shows up in the church. So just those couple first 15 minutes of the episode.
What an introduction, man. I mean, just the opening scene with like her bum baby daddy just summoning a demon for fun, just wild. He's like bored and he pulls out the satanic ritual book. I assume that the young girl Astra was the daughter of Logue and Joanna. Logue was a dude's name. I want to call him Tristan Thompson though, because he seemed like a bum baby daddy. But I can't really tell, but it seems like Logue is definitely the father of Astra and Joanna, whether it's the biological or, you know, stepmother, whatever, mother figure in her life.
So Astra said something like, he said it was an accident, just like what happened to mom. So it seems like he fucked up a ritual previously, and that resulted in the death of Astra's biological mother.
Okay, I'm totally there with you.
So I can reasonably assume that Joanna is not the mom? Mm-hmm.
Yes, but Logue does seem to be the dad.
Yes, confirmed.
Okay. I'm in love with Joanna.
She's awesome. We all are.
Yeah.
Dude, she just walks around with her tits out, man. She like is so confident. It's great. And I love the line where, I mean, it's jumping ahead, but when she's like, get in line, bruv.
Yeah.
Like talking to one of the endless. Like, God, it's so cool.
Mm-hmm. It's cool that we did get to see the satanic ritual thing that Logue was doing, because again, that just means there's just it's kind of like hedge witches from The Magician. There's just random bits of magical information out there. And if you look for it and find it, you can get it and be super irresponsible with it, just like in this case. So I think there's just going to be a bunch of just stray humans that are randomly just bumps in the road for all of our main characters, because anybody can get a hold of these rituals clearly. And
yeah, I'm interested to find out, because obviously we know, you know, Roderick Burgess, the Magus, he was powerful enough to actually, you know, trap dreams. So mm-hmm. I wonder if it's like the Magicians in the sense that there are people out there that are just attuned to the magic more than other people, or if like an average Joe can just pick up one of these books and just start spitting.
I think an average Joe can, but I
need that's cool if it is.
Mm-hmm.
I like that she's already pretty adept at magic too. She seems to appear to be a famous exorcist of some sort, because one, she's about to exorcise a demon that they think is within the princess. And, you know, the priest that she meets with is offering to double, triple her fee. And she's obviously taken the bait on, and she's like, okay, yeah, she clearly loves money. So I thought that was a really cool introduction to her character. Like you guys were saying,
I want to go back to what Paul was saying about, could any average Joe do a ritual? I have reason to believe that that's not the truth. I said in the last recording that I thought the Burgess lineage and that name were going to mean something. I feel like the Constantines clearly have a leg up than the average Joe in terms of magical capabilities. So I feel like some people are more inclined or less inclined. And I feel like the Burgesses and the Constantines are two of those families, which is why I'm a little nervous about Johnny Boy.
Me too.
Around with that ruby.
Yeah. Just to like talk about her appearance again, she's just so confident and just charismatic on screen, and just how she handles supernatural people, like that old lady who shows up and warns her about the Sandman coming back, drops the knowledge that she's 280 years old. She doesn't even blink and just walks right past Dream into the church. Because you know, she seems like she just isn't bothered by these supernatural aspects, which is, again, just awesome, because someone that's just already in the deep end of the magical world and just a badass and clearly good. And it seems like all these characters that we've been introduced through the first three episodes are evil besides her. Like even John and Ethel were questionable. And now I think John's leaning evil. It's good to have somebody on Dream's side besides Matthew and Lucien.
She's not afraid to tell it like it is. And when she's talking about the football player that the princess is marrying, and she's just like, oh, he's rubbish.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not afraid to speak it like how it is.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Brody is rubbish. To go back to that old lady, Hetty, I think her name was, only got that from subtitles. She is really, really interesting. I liked her a lot, just because, one, that she had the knowledge that Dream was coming back and escaped. That's just cool. I don't know how she does that, but she seems way more supernatural mm-hmm. than like Joanna kind of did, just in general. Maybe it's because she's been around for 280 years. But I also, at the end, you know, you kind of see Hetty talking to Dream like one-on-one before Joanna walks up. And I'm like, you got to have some cred to be able to walk up and be like, oh, it was good to have you back, my lord, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so cool. She's a boss, and I want her to come back and kind of meet other people like her, see what the deal is.
I had no idea what her deal is, so I'm glad you asked all those questions so I don't need to. I liked her. I'm glad she was there. I was like, why is she there? And I moved on.
I took it totally as she's just another Lucien type character that's a servant of Dream and was one of the people that decided to leave the Dream realm once it was long enough to realize, okay, Dream's not coming back, you know. And Lucien was the only one that stayed, obviously. But
that's a good guess.
Yeah, I don't know why she was giving, when she said 280 years old, I was like, okay, she's definitely a servant of Dream. And like Paul said, she confirms it by saying my lord to mm-hmm. Dream when he yeah. comes back. So I hope all the servants that we've been introduced to so far create this like round table of characters that are kind of like low-key badass or at least magical enough to like fend for themselves. So we'll see, but
and still help Dream.
Yeah, and still be able to help Dream out. So they all seem loyal. Yeah.
Let's take us back to the church here and get this ceremony, because we get some baseline rules of some of the magic that's going on in the world. And what Joe's here to do is perform an exorcism, and everything you've ever seen from the Exorcist movies seems to apply. Like, even if you've seen the comedy, this is the end. Like, if you start doing Latin and holding the cross sign up, it clearly works and expels demons. And this was an awesome scene, because even though Joanna cuts us short from getting some real good information from this new demon, it was just amazing CGI of him destroying the like being summoned out of the footballer that he was inside and splitting him in half. And he knew who Dream was, and even though he wasn't a servant of Dream, he still like put the respect on his name and all of that, and didn't even want to go back to his own realm in hell. Just a lot of good, subtle information you get from that interaction. And, you know, just badass that he still even put weight on Dream being an endless.
I like that they killed the footballer and provided that level. Cause sometimes when you do those exorcisms, like the people are fine afterwards, like the demon kind of just like gets vomited out of them and they're still fine. But that is physically what would happen. Mm-hmm. Like you would just absolutely get split in half. So I really like that aspect. Did like the little twist that was provided, cause we were led to believe that it was the princess that was the one being exorcised. And she even had those like weird cues in the beginning where she's kind of grabbing the footballer's hand pretty strongly. So I'm like, okay, she's got some strength to her a little bit, maybe. And then once she starts speaking the Latin, it's the footballer that's kind of throwing up a little bit or like gagging. And then you kind of dawns on you like, okay, he's actually the one with the demon. And demon looked badass. He was probably like 8 feet tall too. He was towering over Joanna.
Paul and B-Towns, you know who that reminded me of? Was from Spartacus.
From Spartacus, yeah. Yes. Barca?
Barca. Yes.
Is it Barca?
Yeah, Barca. It's not. No, it is.
Oh, sweet. I'm proud of myself then.
That was good. I didn't remember his name.
Never forget.
Yeah, it's Barker. Barker's a beast. But this whole interaction between Agaleth, and was the demon's name, and Dream was so cool, because just the pure flexing of Dream's knowledge is so cool. He just comes in. He's like, that demon's name is Agaleth. Mm-hmm. Like, he just knows stuff so much. And like Agaleth, like you were saying, puts respect on his name. Like, oh, thank you for recognizing me after all this time, like, and remembering my name. He gives him a jab about his helm, and that's when he gets the wheeling and dealing about, I wonder which demon has your helm, you know. I'll give you the name if you give me the princess. And then Joanna keeps going. He's like, all right, fuck, fine, I'll give you the name, just don't send me back.
Another nod to how badass she is how Endless tries to be like, I command you to stop. And the demon's just like, yo, Dream of the Endless commands you to stop. And she's like, go back to hell, you fucking bitch.
Yeah.
Badass. Really, cool under pressure.
She really is. She was like, fuck it, I want my money. But I actually didn't like the setup for this scene, because when Joanna and Rick, I can't remember. The woman who called her Rick. Like, she comes in and then they hear like a woman screaming, and you see on the subtitles, like, young woman's voice, like, what are you doing to me? So, like, what was that if she's not actually, you know, possessed? It was almost like they were trying to build up the moment of the actual exorcism, but by doing that, they fucked with the continuity of the, well, of,
like,
the scenes.
What if the possessed footballer was like grabbing her because of the demon inside? That dialogue makes sense.
I also think that we got enough information to assume that the princess is kind of a biatch. And so maybe she was just kind of throwing a hissy fit pre-marriage and just like, you gotta, you know, everything's not perfect right now. So I just took it as, in the moment, I took it as, you know, she's possessed, whatever. But looking back, I just think that's maybe just her being a biatch.
Yeah, I mean, either way, at the end, it was all about Agaleth and Dream talking, and then, you know, Joe putting her away. So fuck that princess anyway.
Yeah.
But real quick, do you think Kevin Brody became a famous footballer because he made a deal with a demon? He was like, make me good at footy, and I'll sell my soul to you.
He wouldn't have been rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
He wouldn't have been a bad footballer if he made a deal.
Yeah.
Right, fine.
All right, so let's move right along here, and then the next couple of scenes we'll talk about are just going to be more exposure to Joe's nightmare and Dream showing up in her apartment building, and then the quest to set out to find the sand. And then we'll end this conversation when they are right outside Rachel's apartment building before Joe goes in. So a couple of good scenes here, and it does actually start off with that conversation you already referenced, Paul, when Joe walks out of the church and sees the old lady talking to the My Lord thing. And that's when Matthew gets introduced to.
I love the introduction from Matthew here. Like I said in the beginning, I did not actually expect the bird to physically speak. He says, what's your name? There's like a pretty long pause. I'm like, okay, maybe they're just talking telepathically. And then he's like, oh, I'm Matthew. I'm like, damn. All right. And Patton Oswalt, like, let's go. I'll take it. I think Matthew was a good, is a good comedic relief character that maybe the show didn't desperately need, but the show had been pretty serious and we hadn't really gotten that, like, a comedy based character besides like Cain and Abel, who were only in it for that one scene really. So I think to have a consistent comedic relief character is pretty good for the show. And I think it's a good one with Matthew.
He also doesn't know what the hell is going on with Dream either, so he has to ask a lot of questions. So it's just another exposition dump character. And I'm also curious if the Sandman always has ravens in the source material, two, if Matthew is one of his ravens in the source material, and three, how the community is receiving this Matthew, because I could see this coming across very cringe to someone who, like, passionately loves the actual Raven in the comics.
It's like if Roach from The Witcher could speak, and like they're just kind of recycling Roaches, and did they do a good enough job on Matthew? We'll have to see. I wonder if the Reddit will give us some answers without spoiling too much.
I think that it's because of how centered their dialogue is with giving exposition. It probably is part of the source material, and I also feel like that would be one of the most common complaints from traditionalists, if that's even the right word, like the people that care so much about the source material. So I would guess he probably is relevant, you know. And I think Patton, I was like you, I forget who said it, Paul or Brian, was a little bit hesitant in the beginning, but then it grew on me that by the end, when he's saying fuck and like he's actually giving advice, I was in.
Mm-hmm. I think he has the best line of the episode, which is the last line of the episode. Mm-hmm. But to continue with, you know, Joanna walking away and Matthew being there, like saying, oh, like you lost her. Did you guys get bothered by that at all? First, by being like, Dream didn't even know that this raven was following him, but Joanna did. I'm not too bothered by it, because I was like, he's not expecting one to be following him, so he's not going to be looking for one. But then also, too, like Joanna just walking away and him having no idea. I was like, come on, you're an endless. You got to be paying a little bit more attention.
I did not. I was like, okay, he got distracted by the Raven. Joanna took the opportunity and left. So I didn't.
You know what? Yeah, I'll take that back because it's the first Raven he's seen since Jess and me. And I'm sure he's still totally
thrown off. And he's probably, mad at Lucien too for even suggesting to have this Raven come to him. So he was emotional. Yeah.
That also could be intentional to show us that while he is like Dream of the Endless, he still is like a flawed character. Because he has made several mistakes so far, you know, and been caught off guard. But
yeah, like asking six questions to the fucking face when he only gets three. So I actually have one more question about Dream, and I guess it's easiest to just go along with what happens next. And, you know, Dream's talking to Matthew saying like, all right, well, she's asleep. Then I know exactly how to find her. We get the nightmare. She wakes up from the nightmare. And Dream is there.
Well, first of all, that nightmare was wild. But if you want to point before we get to that, that's fine.
Yeah, I don't want to skip over that.
You got the A-Train treatment.
Dude, totally.
Yeah. I was thinking that too. Okay, so but before we go into the nightmare, you know, Joanna wakes up and Dream is there. Can Dream teleport in the real, or not the real realm, the realm of humanity, the waking realm?
I think it's more like if someone's dreaming, he can access that dream and then appear in front of them after they have dreamt.
That's how I took it too.
So it's not like he's physically teleporting just at the command of his will. It's just he can only travel to places that people are dreaming is how I took it.
Yep.
Yeah, because with his sand, he can pretty much do whatever. But this is before...
This is the first time he's ever been truly free. Because if you're going to reference anything to do with the first time we saw him do this, it was because he was still trapped a little bit and like...
Didn't have any power.
Right now, I think there's no reason to think that this is even an overpowered ability because this is his ability. Like he is a monarch of the dreaming. So he needs to have abilities like this. And I think this was perfectly in line with who his character is, as the king of dreams.
Because he was in the nightmare. Like the nightmare happened and then she woke up. So, and he was in the nightmare watching it.
Right.
And then she woke up and he was there. So that's why I'm just emphasizing. I think it's still the fact that he's just traveling through dreams, and that's how we can get places.
Yeah,
I guess the only thing I had to add was the fact that he was able to intentionally go from the dream realm to London after like he found out the last time the thing got dealt, it was in London. He was like, all right, I'm going to London. So he can pinpoint it in that way. Or did he go through a dream to get there originally?
I wouldn't have enough knowledge to know, but you could assume that he did through a dream. Like people are probably sleeping in London.
He jumped in the water. He jumped in the sea of dreams when he was leaving his realm. And he told Lucien, you know, Joanna's only human. You know, I'm sure. And you talk about the Constantines. If it's anything like her ancestors, they'll serve me well. So he jumped into the sea of dreams in his realm. And then I guess the first time we see him is just at the church in London. So it goes back to traveling through dreams without his sand, because once he gets the sand, all bets off. He fucking teleported right to the ruby in the crate.
I'm good with the dream power, and that essentially means he can teleport pretty much anywhere with or without his sand, so long as people are.
And this is only talking about within Earth realm. Like Earth is its own realm, so it's not like he's just teleporting to Lucifer's throne room. Like I think this is Earth realm. Seems like a pretty neutral ground for all the endless, so I would think that he should be able to do this thing. I'm fine with all that. I think we talk about this nightmare, because like you said, Dave, that girl that we got introduced to at the beginning of this episode totally gets the Robin / A-Train treatment from the boys, and that seems like a defining characteristic of Joe's personality and why she's so not standoffish, but likes to be a lone wolf, so she doesn't involve her powers and demon slaying things involve people around her.
Yeah, she was saying that to Dream as they're walking to the apartment. You know, I don't know if you noticed, but most people around me ended up getting split in half or dragged down to hell. So, you know, that explains a lot. She didn't worry about that until Astra got taken.
My question now is, do we think that there is a chance that that girl is alive?
Hell yeah.
Okay.
I think she is.
I'm glad I just needed one person to say yes, because I guess this just might be my experience with TV. It's just if I don't get that on screen, like actual death, I'm just assuming that she got teleported to another realm potentially. And she's just missing.
Because everything that Joanna does is send people to hell.
So I think she's missing. She would be missing an arm in hell is what I
honestly was hoping that we would get her with like a hook hand. or something in hell in episode four, but mm-hmm. we didn't. So maybe we'll go back. But I mean, her death, 100% Astra's own fault. I mean, yeah. she was told, oh, stay yeah. here. Don't run in to where Giant Demon is. And once she did, she fucking runs in. Yeah.
Stupid. I think the more interesting part of this scene is after she wakes up and Dream is kind of just looking around and gaining information about Joe. Joanna, I don't know if I can call her Joe. I don't think that's ever been said, but easier for note-taking.
I think Rachel calls her Joe.
Okay, yeah, you're right. I think you're right. But what was really great is when everything clicked for Joanna about Dream and Roderick Burgess, aka Tywin. When she starts saying about talking about the legend of the Burgesses and like how she even refers to Roderick as the Demon King, and they say they even said he had the devil himself locked up in his basement. That was such a click moment for her. And I don't know, just seeing the revelation on her face, it seems like everything connected for her, and she's now got more and more into the idea of like, okay, this guy's an endless, I can possibly work with him.
I feel like he did a good job of showing that's a pretty touchy subject for Morpheus, Dream, whatever you want to call him. You know, he was sensitive right when she brought him up. He got like real steely eyed and looked right at her like, yeah, that's what I've been through.
Changed the subject by picking up like the photo booth pictures. I was like, oh, is this you? You look happy and all that. He was like, I don't want to talk about me. Mm-hmm. It's gross.
I hope Roderick is referenced for at least more seasons to come. I just think that was such a great starting point for them. And the fact that even 100 years after his death, people still infamously know of him and what he had done, and people thought he was, I guess, crazy, it sounded like originally, but once word got out that he had captured a demon, or, you know,
the devil.
Yeah. That's just so much respect for Roderick Burgess, who was a short lived character in the eyes of the viewer, but I hope his legacy lives on as like the Demon King.
Roddy Rich.
Yeah. Roddy Rich.
I wouldn't mind him popping back as like a flashback, or seeing him like in another realm, like in hell or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Ready to move along?
Yep.
So what gets us into the next part of their scenes is she finally agrees to help him out after that revelation and after the promise of him removing the nightmare, the reoccurring nightmare that she's having. She's like, all right, I know where it is. It actually clicked because he saw the picture of her being happy with her ex, Rachel. That was a good scene because add a little bit more layer to Joanna. Anyway, the next couple scenes we're going to talk about is the rest of their things together for this first episode. And this is just going to the apartment building, Joanna actually going up and having the vision. And then we'll just talk about Dream giving her the peaceful death, and then just close out Dream and Joanna for episode three. So a lot to talk about here, but let's move right to outside of Rachel's apartment.
It was so funny. Joanna's going in. Dream's like, I'm coming with you. She's like, dude, do you have any idea how much you hate me right now? Do you have any ex-girlfriends? And then he's like, okay, fine, I'll wait outside. I won't wait for long, though. And that's cool because they talked about an ex-girlfriend next episode.
Exactly. We kind of
got an ex-girlfriend.
Yep.
But did this bother you? Because how the hell did Rachel buzz in Joanna? No idea.
Only you would have the answer to that because you're the only person here that has to buzz someone in.
I was like, oh my God, she must have been expecting somebody else. No, she's in bed. How the hell does she open it? I don't know.
Maybe it was that's the sands. A good question. That's a good question. Maybe it's the sands. Just I don't.
My only explanation is the sands are supernatural.
Do you really need, so, yeah, I was gonna say, do you really need an explanation when it's just supernatural events going on?
I like rules, David.
I thought this was a really well done scene because I was not expecting, again, this mini twist within here, because things kind of start off pretty well between them. They're kind of reconciling their differences. And, you know, of course, what's her name again?
Rachel.
Rachel is like fishing for an apology. And then things start to get dark pretty quickly because, you know.
But before it gets
Paul
dark.
Paul sexiest scene. Joanna and Rachel are making out a little bit. And then that's when the emotional turn kind of kicks in. Rachel's looking for an apology from Joanna, and then Dream steps in and just clears away this entire fake scene that never was actually happening. And we see the poor bedridden Rachel. And I thought that was crazy. I really did not expect that at all.
Me too.
I also want to talk about the conversation between Dream and Matthew that happens outside, where he's essentially giving his take on humanity. And we also get to find out a little bit layer by layer who he was as a human. And it kind of seems like he was a bit of an asshole. And he was just like, hey, man, I know what it's like out here. It's tough. They're probably plotting against you right now. That's what I would have been doing. And that's what gets Dream up there to try and break up the conversation. And it's a nice thing. I was talking about in the last recording how Dream kind of looks down on humanity, or it alludes to he has negative perceptions of humanity. And then he has Matthew just completely validating those thoughts. But then he gets a one-on-one with Joanna, who is showing the other side of humanity. Mm-hmm. And when we see what happens to Rachel and she's like decaying and Dream just walks out, she's like, fuck that. You are not letting my ex go out that way. She's like one of the good people. We're not all like Roderick and me. And even he has to step in and be like, no. You're a different kind of bad than Roderick was. So it's just, I like that we're getting.
I get what you're saying.
I'm sorry, I couldn't bring it home, but yeah.
He's getting a perspective of humanity from Matthew that he normally wouldn't get. To go off of that, Joanna last line saying you're not leaving her like this, like she goes to explain, you know, you say you want to save humanity all the time, well guess what, fucking humanity's right here, what are you going to do about it? And we've kind of gotten it a few times that Dream is perceived as like almost selfish and only cares about himself. Corinthian said it at the end of episode 2 when he got sent back and he's talking to Lucienne. So I don't know if we're going to see some character development from Dream about, you know, maybe I have to save humanity and do my job and my duties, but maybe that doesn't mean I have to resent them and hate them. Mm-hmm. Maybe he will like kind of grow to see where they're coming from.
I love all of this conversation because the idea that I was thrown off because I thought Matthew was going to be an angel on his shoulder the whole time, but you guys know me, I love a morally gray being, and that seems what Matthew's going to be. Not only is he just like comic relief, but he's also giving him like a realistic human point of view on humans. And then out of nowhere, like you're saying, Joanna gives him this other side that kind of creates a deeper connection between Dream and the humans. Like he sees it through her because she's slightly changing her. So that's slight character development right there. And I really liked it because Dream, I don't see Dream as evil in any capacity at all. I think he is almost, he's probably the most pure endless based on with the information we've been given so far. So mm-hmm. I love all that. He gives her the peaceful death in her sleep. Just like all around, this was just a great scene for both Joanna, Matthew, and Dream. Like it was just a good ending to this episode. And I just thought, you know, solidified who these characters are and how they're going to be affecting each other as the season goes on.
They had a quick line, and I don't know if it is real or not, because it was technically when Rachel and Joe were dreaming, you know, mm-hmm. Rachel was up and talking. She was like, okay, when you left that night, I called all of your exes. And Joanna was like, you did? Who'd you call? And she looked pissed. And she was like, Sarah, Oliver, and Kit Ryan. I don't know who Kit Ryan is, but Joanna seemed like she was pissed that whoever this was brought back in, and the fact that we got the first and last name.
Did you pick up on the fact, because I didn't write this down, I wasn't going to bring this up, but are you sure those are the names that she says?
Yes.
Because
and I was going to Google them, but I didn't want any spoilers coming up.
The only reason I'm bringing this up now, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, is that I'm pretty sure that Rosemary's daughter is named Sarah. But that's probably a total coincidence. But when she's telling John, when he's in the backseat of his car, about her two daughters, Sarah is one of them.
Sarah and Samantha. And I'm sorry, Paul, how was it different, Sarah? What were those names?
Sarah, Oliver, and Kit Ryan. So three people. They don't overlap names in shows unless they really need to. So that's a great pickup, which I didn't get.
I would think that can't get by without it being like a crazy coincidence.
Kit Ryan is also such a unique name that how can that not be a major player going forward? I just feel like no one's name is Kit Ryan.
So. Might as well. Yeah, they said the first and last names.
Like Chip Skylark.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But I was.
Who are these three people? Who was talking about them? I missed the context.
It was Joanna's exes. Because remember when Rachel's kind of saying, I even called your exes to see if you had run
Got
back
it.
To them.
Yep.
Yeah, and she lists those names. But I was honestly getting a little sexual tension in this next scene between Joanna and Dream just a little bit.
Oh, I'm all in.
I'm all in too. Don't get me wrong, but I just was getting a little hints of it. Just, I think he, like, she's walking away from him. He pops like a little smile. I'm like, okay, this could be doable. This could be doable.
So you're talking about after they leave the apartment building.
Yeah.
Too, right?
So like, yeah, they're talking about it. Matthew shows up and he's like, that was a nice thing you did, mm-hmm. all that good stuff. And then,
I don't know if it was that. I felt the same way, and I'm hoping it is that, but it also could just be mutual admiration, because now Joanna is completely in on Dream being a benevolent force because he did the right thing with her girlfriend. So I don't know. It could be either of just them kind of respecting each other because she also impacted him. But at the same time, whatever it is, I just hope Joanna's in a lot more of this season.
Episode 4 put that down a little bit more for me, because we got introduced. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but we got introduced to Dream's ex-girlfriend. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's also a potential love interest for Dream going forward. So we'll see. Yeah. But I just was definitely getting that vibe at the end of that.
And so, Paul, you think the best line of these two episodes happened at the end of episode 4?
No, this line right here.
Yeah, it's this one, 100%. Go ahead.
It's so good. So Matthew's talking to Dream. He's like, so where are we headed next? And, you know, after arguing whether or not Matthew is even going to come along with Dream, he's like, you know what? You might be useful. So, you know, just hang on tight. And he's like, cool, where are we going? He goes, hell. He goes, I don't know, like hell, like hell? Like, I don't know about that. Like, Lucien will not be in favor of hell going, but I have a feeling that you're not listening. So fuck it. Let's go to hell. Yes. Oh my God. That was so good. Just fuck it. We're going to hell. Like, he's just leaning in. It's so perfect.
And once that line was delivered in the way it was by Patton, I was all in. Like, I wasn't looking back. Matthew's good in my book. All right. So that is the end of Dream sequence. Scenes in all of episode 3. So what we're going to do here is we're going to kind of overlap between episode 3 and 4, and we're going to start with everything to do with John Burgess, aka so Ethel Cripps's son. So we're going to cover all of his scenes in episode 3 with Ethel herself, and then we're going to flow right into his scenes in episode 4, just because it's all kind of connected and it might as well be in the same episode. And then after we close off with the Rosemary and John stuff, we'll leave the last scene alone to converge with all of Dream's scenes in episode 4. So let's back up a little bit in episode 3 here. And we're back in Buffalo, New York. We're still in the prison. This is exactly where we left off at the end of episode 2. And we just have some good dialogue front to back here for Ethel and John, them catching up, kind of reconciling here, and some big, big moments and dialogue happens around the amulet of protection. But let's talk about everything that happens here until Ethel's death.
I'm just going to jump right into the amulet of protection talk, because we had discussed it in our first episode or first two episode recording that we were under the assumption that the ruby was what kept her young all those years. But she explicitly says here that the amulet of protection is what kept me young all these years. I still believe that the ruby, just as a side effect, would extend her life as well. Like, even if she was just around it, I still think she would have not aged at all. Like, we already got that confirmation too, but it was just a little weird that both of these gems offered the same abilities of extending life, which I wasn't crazy about, because why not? I guess I get where she's coming from, where she wants to get rid of the ruby so she doesn't have Dream come after her. But at the same time, I don't know. It's weird.
I'll buy it, because that's obviously an established perk of the ruby, and she sought out an amulet of protection. I feel like that would extend your life. Like, an amulet of protection is supposed to protect you, i.e. not die, i.e. not age. So, like, she was looking for something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not, like, totally disagreeing, because I have the same thoughts too, but, like, the actual verbiage, I believe, was she said, it kept me alive for 116 years. And I took that as people were coming for her this whole time. I still agree, though.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like,
okay. Okay.
So I don't think there's a chance that the amulet itself wasn't keeping her young and it was still being, you know, the ruby. But I feel like, okay, so to back up, Corinthian said just being around and endless has its benefits. And then Dream goes on to say that these objects that he has are part of him. So even though it's a bag of sand, it's still part of dreams still,
right?
You know,
so the vestments are synonymous with basically being around the endless and getting the benefits.
That's how I'm taking it
in certain aspects, because the sands literally killed Rachel. Like, that's what the sands,
but it was also, so it's not, it was like, keeping her alive. She says, yeah, he said
keeping her alive, but that was, those were also the reasons she, like, if she'd never had that bag of sand, I don't think she would have looked like that.
Well, she didn't eat. She didn't eat or anything. I thought she was just laying there for 6 months, and that's why she became like that, because she sat in bed and was basically high on the sands the whole time.
I didn't think about it like that, but I think that would be a good explanation as well. Okay.
Making some good points.
Yeah.
It's also worth saying that John only stole the ruby 30 years ago, so she was in possession of the ruby and its effects up until 30 years ago. And it looked like in the scenes where she was in the hospital prison with John, she had aged into her 50s or something. Like, she looked intentionally older than when she was young in like the flashbacks to Roderick era. Like, she had aged. Maybe that was just how I took it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I think you guys, like, Paul, you actually made a lot of good points there. And the specificity of the dialogue there changed the entire thing for me when you, because she does say the amulet of protection kept her alive for 116 years. Nothing about the aging, but when she takes it off, she does age. So that gets weird again.
I agree.
I'll just say is that this is honestly, through three episodes, this is the first red flag of writing I've seen, which is kind of good because it's not that big of a deal because of all these random variables that can also keep you young, like being around the endless, the vestments, the amulet of protection, all of this shit can kind of play out where maybe there are no plot holes in the writing, but this is the first red flag through almost 3 hours of television in a fantasy series. So I'm honestly okay with it. But again, it bothered me. This is the first thing that truly bothered me.
I guess it would make sense if you had even just in our world, you know, just the regular world, if we came across a magical item, it would make sense that it would just, no matter what, extend your life just a little bit. You know, just it would surge you some power, I guess, you know, just to make you live longer. But yeah, we might be overthinking it a little bit, but yeah, maybe just like a tiny little red flag.
I see why Alki complained about it to us now.
Yeah,
because he had this information when we were having the conversation and we only had the information of episodes 1 to 2. So we weren't having a full conversation, but
it makes sense.
I don't know.
It was worth bringing up still.
What is the exact problem, though, that you're taking issue with?
That she dies after she takes it off.
It could have, there could be like a possession or ownership aspect to it because she traded for it and then she passed it down intentionally to John, who then intentionally gave it to Rosemary.
I don't know.
It's a stretch. I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. We don't have enough information, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we might get it because it feels like investment conversations are bound to happen constantly and power conversations. So I think we put a pin in it. There's nothing else we can really take away. I think we voiced our complaints in a respectable way.
Yeah, like it's not a big deal. It's just something that makes us as viewers a little bit more confused.
Yeah, because we're pretty damn near perfect up to this point in my head.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's supernatural, right? So you got to have like wiggle room to a certain degree.
I also don't like the buzzer thing either now.
Yes. Sorry. So I keep ruining the show. Yeah. To go back to John talking to Ethel in the beginning, we kind of get more of his background of, you know, oh yeah, I killed those people, but they were bad people. They were trying to steal from me. Mm-hmm. So like, how long did John have this ruby before he went crazy and killed these people? We know he's been in prison or hospital, psychiatric hospital for 30 years. So I would like to get a timeline to see how much time he spent with the ruby to be able to do what he did at the end of episode 4.
I could see us getting some flashbacks of it because he does mention, this is the perfect time to mention it, that he had tinkered with the ruby so that only he could use it. So I would like to see what exactly he did that meant tinkering. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be a good explanation and help us get a little bit of the timelines more clear as well.
Did we also cover that while in prison, John put the dots together that he was Roderick Burgess's son? So now he is equipped with that information.
Yeah,
which is good.
We skipped over that, but that was like the first thing that got brought up between Ethel and John. You're right.
This was a true reconciliation, though. Like, she completely forgave him for everything he did, and like, she passed it on. And again, total mind fuck to me. I did not see Ethel going out this early. And I can just give the approval to Brian's opinion in the beginning, because she turned out to be almost pure good.
I have a note. Rip Ethel. She died one of the good ones.
Yeah,
because she did the exact. Yeah. Love it, Ethel. Yeah. Good job. Way to prove me right.
She almost seemed like she learned, because she was like, I want to give the ruby back. Like, I don't want this. Maybe he'll forgive us. Yeah. Like, she kind of learned how powerful these forces are that they're messing with. But again, did she know she was going to die when she took the...
Yeah,
I guess. Like,
he had to have, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. She knew. I do like, because in the beginning of this conversation, John really does seem like he's going to push more to side with Roderick, because the way his mom's like kind of lying to him, he's like, you've always lied to me about this stuff. And then when she says your father literally wanted to abort you, that was the switch in John's mind where it's like, okay, now I kind of see why you're a good person, and what now I'm kind of getting the full picture of the abuse that you probably took from Roderick. Mm-hmm. So I really like that John was smart enough to not follow in Roderick's path, but kind of side, have enough empathy for his mom and what she had done for him, and still make him a villain. Though he's still going to be a villain, even with all this like heart to heart that he had with his mother and like squashing a beef, he's still going to be this villain, which I can't wait to see.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing. Her dying words is, nobody can hurt you now, so you don't need the ruby, just let it go. And at the end of episode 4, he makes the conscious decision, I don't want safety, I want the ruby.
I think
it's villain mode.
I think that plays right into what happened to Joanna's ex, Rachel. It's kind of like the vestments are drugs.
Yeah,
like they make you dependent on them. So I think that's John's reasoning, because to me, give me the amulet of protection every day of the week. Holy shit, that thing is awesome. Someone shoots you with a bullet, they explode. Like, what the fuck? Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
that was so crazy.
And up until that moment, I was begging John to somehow turn into at least at worst a neutral force, but clearly by the end of episode 4 he's going to be pure evil. Well, from a human side,
he's kind of neutral in the sense that he wants good in the world. You know, that was his, what was his exact quote at the end of episode 4? He's like, I want to protect the world or some shit like that.
He wants
That's
to save
what
the
all
world.
Villains claim exactly. they're doing. Exactly. Yeah, Kane from Naruto thinks he's saving the
he
world.
He could have been like, oh, I just want to murder everyone. Like, these people killed my mom, I want to murder everyone. But he's like, no, I want to protect those who are good. So
it's, Dave is a supervillain in the making. He is agreeing with John's ideologies. He does seem like he's going to be an awesome villain. And I'm almost glad he gave up the amulet, because if he had the ruby and the amulet, nobody was touching this dude.
Yeah. I agree with Dave, though. Like, after episode 2, I was, you know, it's Lupin, this is amazing, like nostalgia, it's going to be great. And then he just turned it up to a whole nother level in every second of screen time he had. Just the way he was delivering dialogue calmly in the back of all the Rosemary scenes, the way he just seems, he's obviously a little crazy and unhinged, but he's also is calculated and kind of has some sort of magic sense. He might not be as good at magic as maybe Joanna or his father, but he seems like he's on the rise and he knows what these vestments are capable of doing. So it's going to be fucking awesome to see him be a whole separate force from the Corinthian if he doesn't team up with him, which I hope they don't.
One thing that you said there just reminded me, I just wanted to bring this up too, is when Dream and Joanna are talking, like in the bedroom or whatever, or maybe even before they get to Rachel's apartment, he says, I need more magic than even you can muster. So that just is kind of emphasizing the gap between Dream and maybe humans and Joanna. But it sounds like even in Dream's eyes, Joanna is not even that strong of a magic wielder. Mm-hmm. So I still want some human like action to see like who would be the strongest magus or whatever you want to call it in as a human, you know?
Yeah.
So we haven't talked about a pretty big line that John had talking to Ethel, where she's saying, you know, the Sandman's back, like he's going to be coming for the ruby. And John's saying, why would we give up a ruby that makes dreams come true when we can dream of the world without a Sandman? So I'm like, shit, like, is he just going to dream Morpheus away? Like, is he not going to exist anymore? Like, how, what did you do to this ruby and what can the ruby grant? Like, is it only a dream for you? Like, I don't even know.
It does put more weight on the power of the ruby.
Hell yeah. And John, in that fact, now he's got it back. I feel like Morpheus is definitely in a lot more trouble.
He gave some very specific examples when talking to his mom about the powers. Like, when he was a kid saying, for my birthday, I just wished for a pony and it popped up, or I wished for it to be winter in my room and it was. Like, that's really cool, because I didn't get that vibe from, I know they were saying it, Grant's wishes and nightmare, whatever, all that stuff. But like, it's good to get specific examples of the kind of rules that we're working with.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I mean, I was going to say, what are the rules for this amulet of protection here?
No, because rules, baby. That's
we
rule.
Got them. It almost looks like an eye. It looks like a pupil inside of a ring. So I don't know if it's part of a demon or what that was made in the trade. But I mean, for a security guard that comes in, you know, don't even fucking shoot him. Like, come on. Let this woman that walked in is now a zombie. She's a freaking mummy compared to when she aged so much differently. You got to know something's going on there. Don't fucking shoot that guy.
This was the thing that I really loved about John, too, is that to me, he was being very genuine and sincere when he was telling the guard, like, please don't shoot me. You're going to regret it. And he did the same thing at the convenience store with the guy. He had this tone in his voice that made me think he was sympathetic to these people.
He's not the one killing them.
Yeah, he's like, please don't shoot me. Like, I will, like, something bad will happen if you do it. And he's warning them, but obviously no one's exposed enough to magic to believe him. So,
you know who that reminds me of? Young Gaara from Naruto, when he's like, please don't hit me. And the sand just comes in and fucking
fucks him up,
kills everybody trying to assassinate him. He's like, look, I told you, please don't kill me.
But Dave, what you just brought up right there is actually something that stuck out insanely for me for his character at the end of episode 4. I know I'm jumping ahead, but we only have like one or two more scenes before we're there anyway, is the fact that I thought he was going to kill Rosemary, but then he proved again that he really isn't out here to fuck with you unless you're stopping him from doing his dream, which is fine. Like, you know, that's much better than a pure evil like demon, right? Like, he has a goal, and if you're going to fuck with him, you're going to be screwed over. And he's trying to save as many lives as possible in his own head. So I kind of like that aspect of it. He's not just going to be a demon.
Xerath from Fairy Tale.
Hey, that's a good point. That's a good comparison. Yeah.
He just like happens that he just kill people he doesn't want to.
If you touch him, you're going to die. Yeah.
I like
that. How many does he get here? Is it three or is it five?
He gets two three, in the kills? Three out of the three at the hospital. So it's the first guard, the two in the elevator, and then
gas station.
So four.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's move along to get us to that point, because the only thing that we covered the whole his escape from the psychiatric ward, but the only thing left that actually happens at the very, very end of episode 3 is the Corinthian. I don't even know if we're using that wrong, because I'll feel bad if some OGs correct us that his name is actually Corinthian, but I like the Corinthian. It sounds cool. I feel like he knows, bro. He knows that he got out and he gives him the jacket.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. Oh, it's too cold out to be out here without a jacket. It was like, the only thing that matters to me is that you get to where you're going.
Yeah, that was so hot. I was like, these are going to be two of my favorite characters going forward, I think, right here. Is the Corinthian that they're just looking at each other. Oh, that shit was hype, man.
Dave, so a super villain confirmed. Yeah. This is a bad pairing. That could be trouble, but too am excited for it, Dave, because Dream needs a worthy adversary. He's a fucking god.
I'm putting this on the board right now. This is going to be one of our first board predictions that I'll read back in the finale episode. I want everybody's opinion. Are they going to be allies, Corinthian and John?
Yes, but only in the sense that Corinthian's going to... I think John's just a pawn to him. I think John could probably be like a big bad of this season, and then Corinthian maybe later down the road. I think Corinthian's just using him as a pawn. But yes, in a sense, I think that would make them allies.
Dave's a yes. Paul?
I'm going to guess yes, they are going to become allies, because, you know, Corinthian can't use the ruby because it's made of the same stuff he is. They already talked about that. But Corinthian's got all the info on Dream and, you know, the dreaming and all that stuff. So hopefully John will be able to hit Dream's weak points way harder.
Okay. B-Toms?
I think they'll be allies in the sense that Corinthian will try to help him against Dream, and Jonathan will accept his advice and information. I think he might continue with the hands-off approach. Just, hey, I'm just pushing you in the right direction. I don't know if he'll be like his number two or they'll be like full-on partners or what, but yeah, I think there will be somewhat of an alliance there.
Okay. So that's three yeses, and I'll just put it on the board that I'm going to say no, because I'm thinking with my heart here rather than in my head. I think B-Town, as you put it perfectly, of what I actually think will happen, but I'm begging for these two to be separate obstacles and not working together. Cause even if they end up confronting each other too, that seems to be fun television for me. So I'm putting it.
I will say, I think it would be good for John's character if he like met Corinthian, found out what his actual deal was, and he was like too extreme, too like much of a nightmarish demon for him. Like he has some morals. I don't know.
All right. So let's take us to, we're going to keep continuing on with John's stuff that happens in episode 4, A Hope in Hell. And this is with Rosemary picking him up right after he met with the Corinthian. And we talked about a lot of this. I don't know if there's anything else you guys really want to bring up about the specific conversation they have in the car where he explains the backstory about his mother, aka Ethel, and how she was a thief. We kind of put that all together from the context of the first three episodes. And then the whole gas station thing happened. So anything else you guys want to bring up that we didn't cover before we get to the warehouse scene at the end?
I just really like the car scene. That's honestly really it. I thought John just did a really good job just kind of showing his colors a little bit, to the point where I even worried Rosemary. At first she was getting good vibes from him, and then she was like, oh shit, maybe this guy's a little loony, he's a little crazy in the head. And it was all very subtle, like the escalation of it getting to the point where Rosemary has to call 911, I think was just really well done. I just thought both acting performances, especially John's here, was really well done.
I think there was a point where you can just see his acting flip like a switch, where he went from kind of coming across as like a confused elderly man who doesn't know where he is to like kind of a manic murderer who like, oh shit, I'm in trouble with this stranger in my backseat. And I wanted to point that out. But also, I think it was good to get how John perceived his mother when he's just saying it unfiltered, letting off steam to a stranger. Like he was just like, yeah, this is kind of why I am the way I am and a little bit fucked up. We were moving around all the time. Like she put me in prison. I won't say I didn't deserve it, but like she did lock me up. I had to steal from her. Like it was a good conversation.
Totally.
It gave us a really good look at his mindset of how he views everybody. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, I did some bad things that might be morally ambiguous, but there was people trying to take something of mine from me. And then he even goes in deeper to say, you know, once you realize that all these other people are doing these actions because they're selfish, because they're evil, it makes it easier to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And to go back to what you guys are saying, he's not really evil. He doesn't want to kill everybody. He just wants to kill who he perceives as bad people. It gives you a good idea of what he's trying to get rid of. And that's just don't fuck with him and you should be good.
It's kind of just forming his villain manifesto. Like these are his goals. These are his ends. And it was a good scene to do it.
They did it in like minimal amount of minutes too. And it was super effective. Mm-hmm. So like, that's just good writing.
Yeah. I love how he didn't lie at all either.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, like, what'd your mother do for a living? He was like, oh, she stole. Mm-hmm. And he never lied. And he even went on to ask her, like, what do you think of lying, Rosemary? And he's like, I think people lie to protect themselves. And she goes on to say, I think people lie because they're afraid and they don't want to get hurt. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, okay, Rosemary, you're a good person.
He was a little bit open to that viewpoint too, which I appreciated. He was just like, you taught me something new about humanity, but now we can get to the gas station scene.
Even after, I don't think I even have anything to mention.
Yeah, I think we did a good job of talking about that first. Well, we are going to pick back up with Rosemary, but if there's anything else you wanted to bring up, E-Times, go ahead.
Nah, not really. You know how I just like to take us from scene to scene.
Let's get to the fucking meat and potatoes of this goddamn span of two episodes.
Yeah, for real.
Hell yeah. Let's go to Tartarus, Hades, Avernus, aka Hell, baby. This is just, if you forgot how good the CGI was in the first two episodes because the third one didn't do too much, this brings us right the fuck back, because the hellscape is incredible and the palace that we end up seeing is just beautifully done, all in this new realm. This is, if you're going to count the dreaming earth, and then this is our third realm we physically have seen. This is just the start of everything. I think this is going to be so important. The characters we meet here, maybe characters if you want to count Lucifer's underling, but Anyway, the first bucket of scenes we'll talk about is just the arrival of Matthew and Dream in hell. And then also just them walk, basically everything up until they get to the palace. So the whole meeting of Squatter Bloat, I think his name was, walk, and then meeting of the X, and then walking the path. So three big scenes, everything before the palace.
First thing I want to say, hell looks incredible, man. They just add so many little things to it that don't really need to. Because they don't explain it. Like when the gate's opening, like the big second gate, like blood starts bubbling up from the ground. And it's like they don't touch on it. And you know, it was only 1 second scene, but it adds so much to the environment of what this realm is. And they did a phenomenal job. I mean, the first thing they see is all these damned, and they're like, I guess we should follow the damned. And Matthew's like, holy shit, they make you carry your own fire? Like, that's brutal.
It's cold in hell. I like that there appears to be a tier of punishment. Like, I'd rather be in a prison cell than growing inside of a tree. I don't know if you guys were thinking the same thing, but definitely. I appreciate tiers to the punishments. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd be that stone wall guy who hands the dude the mallet.
Stone wall guy. Could you imagine doing that for eternity?
And it was really cool. On the rewatch, I noticed as he rung the bell, everybody else of the stone people around there were like, oh my God, like covering their ears and screaming. They like hated it. So it was just like their own specific form of torture.
Yeah. Dude, there were some epic, epic quotes here where shout out to Solo Leveling here, Dave. I know you call it Monarchs a bunch of times, yeah, but when Monarchs. When Dream says to Matthew, a king may not enter another monarch's realm uninvited, there are rules. Just fuck yeah, inject that shit into my veins. I love the respect because Dream is nothing if not a sucker for all of these endless rules. And he's the only one that clearly like seems to hold to all of them. But this Squatter Bloat motherfucker is just trying to fuck with Dream when they first talk to each other. And Dream is just taking zero freaking respect. He's like, do you know who the fuck I am? Like, your fucking lord will kill you if you find out how you're disrespecting me.
Although we do find out that Lucifer has not a lot of respect for Dream, and that Squatter Bloat was kind of in his right to be like, oh yeah, your Dream of the Endless, where's your crown? Mm-hmm. Oh, don't have that? Where's your ruby? Don't have that either? Well, who the fuck are you? Mm-hmm. But the way he stands his ground is good, and I have to say, there's one at the door at the gate of damnation. Is it thief, thug, or whore? There's one at the door, and there's room for one more until the end of creation.
Yes.
And Dream gets past him by saying a rhyme too, which I forget, but I feel like demons respond to rhyme schemes.
Yes, Dream responded with, he was saying something about, should I use my ruby on you? And fucking give you nightmares. But Squatter Bloat's question to him right before that. So they're going back and forth like, oh, you're a monarch? I don't even, you know. And Dream says, I am a monarch of my own. Like, watch your tongue. And Squatter Bloat says, where's your ruby? So I don't know if that meant where's your ruby to prove that you're, you know, Dream of the Endless. Or is that saying, oh, you're a monarch? Then where's your ruby proving that you're a monarch? So are all these other monarchs going to have rubies too?
Like have their own vestment gems. That would be cool. Like, yes.
I hope they do.
Yeah, Desire has the sapphire. Like, that'd be cool as shit. Like,
oh my God, fuck yeah. Yeah, I don't know, because that to jump forward, you know, Lucifer says at the end, like, oh, I know how you rely on your tools so much. And, you know, they're a point of weakness or whatever. But that being said, I still hope that each monarch has a ruby to identify that they are a monarch of a realm.
That would be so sweet.
Yeah.
I hope Destiny has the amethyst, because it kind of sounds like manifest destiny, which is a thing. It's okay. Not anything, but it's a thing.
So then, okay, that works with sapphire, desire, amethyst. Yeah.
Works with the rhyme scheme too of the demons.
Yeah. Also, while we're talking about the siblings, I think it was confirmed that Lucifer is not death and is not one of the siblings. She is above, and we'll put all the respect on her name when it becomes time.
Incredibly, incredibly important dialogue. And that blew my mind, because I was in the mindset that death was Lucifer. But what he says is that he gives a whole lore drop about Lucifer to Matthew, which is just perfect, because it's one of my favorite pieces of dialogue here. He says, Lucifer, Morningstar, blah, 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 used to be Samael. I think that's how he pronounced it. The fallen angel. And he said, even more important here, save only the creator. Lucifer is perhaps the most powerful being there is, by far more powerful than myself. So the fact that there's a creator, meaning like a god, like an almighty, that's also going to not be one of the endless, is just, to me, just fuck yeah, let's make that happen. That should be like a season four reveal. Yep. Like when God appears, like we don't need
sprinkle them in here and there. Yeah.
Yes, man. That to me was the best type of seed planting.
That was amazing. That was a, that was like chills kind of seed planting. Absolutely. The one thing I will say, like, as we're getting to the palace is, do you think Squatter Bloat's reasoning for not taking Dream and Matthew, like, I guess the correct way to the palace was so he could pass his ex-girlfriend? Like, you know, like they're going up the cliffside and Matthew's like, oh, this doesn't seem like the way to the palace. And Dream's kind of like, you know what, you're kind of right. And then in that moment, he comes across that girl who refers to him as, I can't pronounce that name. It was like high school, like
Kai Cool.
Yeah. So do you think Squatter Bloat did that, I guess, based on like Lucifer's orders, maybe to kind of show, leverage? Yeah. Kind of some leverage, like say like, oh, we have your ex-girlfriend hostage here. And because Squatter Bloat like kind of smiles when Dream's like done talking with her, or maybe in the midst of their conversation. So to me, it looks like he was doing this on purpose.
I really like that quick moment.
I mean, he says to Matthew, like, they are showing me that they were prepared for my arrival.
Okay.
Like this is like almost all of a flex, almost like trying to put him in like a more vulnerable position or mindset or something like that. And it was like, oh yeah, by the way, we still have your fucking bitch down here.
And
10,000 years.
Yeah. The information that we get is that she's not a 10,000 years ago. She was the leader of the people called the first people. And I just felt like I was tripping when I was seeing this conversation happen, because she sees him in a different body completely.
I love that. Really just cool.
And it just the fact that, you know, Dream was clearly predated the first humans on Earth. So that was just more, you know, 10,000 years goes back to how he was capable of sitting in that glass cage for 100 years and not talking, because time is probably fake to him. Like, he's been alive forever. So just a bunch of little things there. And then again, Paul, you brought it up. That's the X that was hinted at when he had the conversation with Joanna, which was amazing.
It's been 10,000 years and I still love you, but I have not yet forgiven you. Yeah. You haven't forgiven somebody in 10,000 years. God damn. What did she do?
She
is in hell for it.
And he put her there. Matthew's like, what the fuck?
That means cross realm collaboration right there.
What are your guys' theories on why Dream was a different character back then versus now? Do you think he could like occasionally alters his appearance every so often kind of thing? Or I just want to hear what your guys' thoughts are on that.
I kind of took it like Zeus. Zeus would just like pop down into humanity's realm for a little bit. And, you know, at the time, if they're the tribe of the first people, and kind a white dude in. Walk. Yeah. If a white dude walks down there, they're going to be like, fucking kill that thing. So he needed to represent himself as something that she would be familiar with.
Yep.
That's what I thought too.
Fell in love with a mortal. She betrayed him. So he punished her to the damnation. Sounds like exactly what happened.
Is that,
you think she banged Lucifer?
That is definitely a storyline in Greek mythology.
Yeah.
I can't remember who's.
Are we ready to move on to the next little piece here?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is going to be everything from his arrival to the palace all the way until pre-start of the challenge. So don't talk about the actual challenge itself, but everything up until that point. So just one real scene, one real long scene that has so much good stuff in it.
Just the CGI was fucking incredible. Of the gates, the satanic cross on the gates, and the two, I think they're goats or rams, right, that are next at the side. I just thought it looks absolutely incredible. This was definitely my favorite like scene to look at wise, and how the gates were opening. I thought it was just so badass.
So cool. I already talked about like the blood boiling up and just like as we go past all the prisons, you saw like a bunch of the pillars and prisons too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really cool realm in general.
I'll be honest
just
though.
Just to visit, not to live in.
Yeah.
I will be honest, though, with the introduction of Lightbringer, Lucifer, I wasn't crazy on
her look. I kind of liked it because she's so big. She's so towering.
Yeah, I like
and
that.
Like, looking down at Dream, you actually see like the height difference pretty crazy. Drastically.
The only thing I liked was the wings, really. I wasn't crazy about the character.
I don't know. Maybe it was the hair. That.
Maybe it was the hair. It was the hair that probably... Yeah. She had a grandma-style haircut that threw me off.
I didn't think that at all. They went for their own take on the character, for sure, but it's doing it for me. I think also you consider that it's supposed to be a fallen angel, you can see kind of those aspects of purity in the character still that she's trying to present. But then the contrast with her devil wings in the back, which the wings I thought looked fantastic. Mm-hmm. She had like an imposing presence and she was doing it for me.
Her introduction was all I could ever dream for because I knew she was in the show, Brienne, as Lucifer. I just didn't know what really to expect past that. I don't know if you guys had that as a spoiler, but two things that happens right off the bat that's fucking amazing for me. And Brian, you already said the one, I think it was you, Brian, that you brought up. She confirms right there that Death as a sibling to Dream is a completely different character. And I can't even imagine what realm Death holds if it's not hell. So that's its own fucking thing. But that was a great revelation. And then right away, she asked Dream, she says, are you here to ally with me as the sovereign realm that I'm trying to be? Which again, just hints at the war she has with God. Yeah. I think Joanna actually refers to God as God. So like we're allowed to, I think we could just say that either way it's building up for that seems to be like an end game kind of thing. And then I'm just all in because, you know, I hate religion, but I love religion and fiction because I think it just the ceiling for how good it can be and cool and mystical is just right there.
We also get the introduction of that side character who I'm guessing would have to have a bigger part in this later on. But I think her name Mazikeen.
Yep.
Mazikeen of Lilum.
Yep. You got it.
That, I thought her character design was fucking sweet with like the half two-face looking face. Just really badass. And she definitely is going to be following Dream is how I took it by the end of this episode. Like she'll be stalking him in the background and just keeping a tab on him because clearly at the end of this like Dream and Lucifer are kind of like button heads, so I think she'll come back for sure pretty soon.
Yeah, Lucifer was cool, just one walking over to him, just putting her hand in the fire just to prove that she could do that. And then two, when he's talking about the helm, she's like, oh, like, you know which demon has it? Oh, you don't? Well, I guess I'll just summon all of them. And that was just like a big, like, do you know what you walked into?
Mm-hmm.
And
so
it was
playful
just,
and confident, badass.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And the fact that she was saying, Luke, you already said it, like, oh, did you come to merge your realm with my realm and join forces? So cool.
Have we gotten any? So we definitely know of Despair, Death. And what was the other, like, what are the siblings' names?
Desire. All right. So far she said Destiny, Death, Despair. That's the one she listed.
But we know of
Desire's another one.
Right. Because I'm just only thinking of this because when she does kind of start listing them out, she goes like Destiny, Death, Despair. And then she kind of like does this like look away and others. So I guess I forgot about the couple others that we had already been introduced to. But that just kind of made me think that maybe there's too many for her to even keep up with. Like those are the only three that are kind of important to her. Like, of course she would know Death. Despair also makes sense. Destiny a little bit in ties of like hell and everything. But
yeah,
I think maybe those three are just the ones who work closest with her.
10 seasons. Each one gets one season.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. I'm in.
That would be that would be so sweet. I think that'd be
cool
great.
With that.
What did you guys think of Corazon or whatever? The Duke of Hell. One of the Duke of Hells.
Yeah. No, I thought this was great because she just summons him. He figures it out by using his sands, right?
Yeah. He's like, the sands will bring what is mine to me in hell.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay.
Yeah, well, first she like summons the entire demon army and she's like, what do you want to do, Dream? You want to interview each one of them individually? And he's like, nah. Yeah. I got
middle
this.
Finger.
Yeah.
Do you guys recognize that demon Corazon? I don't even know how to say it. I'm saying Corazon, and that's just hard
that's
in Spanish.
That's One Piece.
yeah, why? So, is he a famous actor?
He's not a famous actor. He is like a British personality. He's more like of an influencer. His name is Munya Chihuahua. He's from Zimbabwe, but he like lives in England right now. He's just like an influencer. He plays footy and whatnot. This seems to be a very British show, like up and down.
Yeah, bro. get over.
Yeah, the only American accent is Corinthian, and he's an evil bastard. Yeah. So it's really cool. But
this motherfucker had death flags written all over him, and I'm like I was just like, the second this guy showed up, and then the challenge happens for the helm, which is like what Dream offers up as the counterpiece for the helm is eternal slavery. Yeah, yeah, to him. And then, you know, the second he said he was allowed to pick a challenger, it's like, okay, he's going to pick Lucifer. But I thought it was just going to be a death match between the two of them, which I also would have been down with, because I wanted Lucifer to somehow be good. I've been hoping all these eventual villains are going to somehow be good, because I love that trope subversion. But as soon as he's like, you're allowed to pick a challenger, he says Lucifer, I was like, okay, she's pure, just straight evil, she should be, I guess.
I wanted
the outfit. The fucking outfit change is so smooth.
That was smooth, yeah.
He says, like, you know what? I pick, you know, you, sire. Mm-hmm. And Lucifer is in the white, and then you see Dream's face, and then all of a sudden behind Dream, you see her walking in, and now she's in completely black. Like, ready to throw down.
And that stare down, dude, put it on an MMA poster, man. Yeah. When they stood up to each other, and he's looking up because, what's her name? Gwendolyn Christine, I think is her name, Brienne's actor's name. Just epic. That was like a picture right there. Just that them looking into each other's eyes, beautiful. And Dream not backing down at all.
It's so cool. He goes, I have accepted the terms. Mm-hmm. And he turns around, and then he has a new outfit on. He's like, let the challenge begin. I was like, God damn it. You guys are quick change masters.
I will run us through what they say for each level of the challenge, and then we could just talk about it as a whole, because I feel like it's too much to pick apart piece by piece. But if you guys are ready, I'll just do that, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah, the only thing I want to say is the demon is giving the introduction before the game happens. And he's like, the oldest game, you know, a game of skill, confidence, and transformation. Mm-hmm. And that's all the information we had going in. And I was like, what are we getting into?
Yeah.
He announces Dream, and all the demons are like, boo. Love it.
Two, my lord.
Yeah.
The only thing that happens before the challenge starts is Matthew tries to give him a little pep talk, and he wants to send Matthew back. But Matthew says, fuck that. Either way, challenge starts, and instantly Lucifer, who is the challengee, picks to be a dire wolf, aka Game of Thrones. They totally fucking did that on purpose. Like,
this has gotta be just complete setup, because how can you have Brienne of Tarth in your show and then her and choose a dire wolf?
Yeah.
A dire wolf of all things.
So she becomes a dire wolf, into which he becomes a hunter, into which she becomes a serpent that poisons him, and then he becomes a bird of prey to kill the snake. Then,
Witcher.
What?
I just said the Witcher, because whenever bird of prey, I always just think of Cahir with the helmet with a bird of prey.
And then to combat the bird of prey, she becomes a butcher bacterium decaying. It just completely like decays Dream. And then he becomes a world with life nurturing powers, to which she becomes a nova, which I that was one of my favorite parts. She becomes a supernova that explodes the planet, and then he becomes the universe, all-encompassing, life-embracing, which she in turn becomes anti-life, which is, she says, is the beast of judgment, the dark at the end of everything. And then it ends with Dream becoming hope, thanks to the pep talk of Matthew, which I thought it was amazing. Dave wasn't the biggest fan. We'll talk about that, but before we get our opinions more, Brian and Paul, what was your thoughts on this whole challenge back and forth flashing?
I liked it. It was good. And when she like took it up a notch and was just like, okay, I'm a butcher bacterium, and he was back reeling on the defense, and she was just like, I'll go. And I'm okay with the cop out being hope, because what kills hope, man? Nothing. That's like hell's weakness, or her weakness is just like, people fucking hope for better. Can't kill hope, man. Mm-hmm. Not going away. He stumped her.
Thought she was going to be God. Honestly, I thought he was going to say God,
and that would have been the creator. Yeah,
yeah.
The way he was like standing back up and saying, you know, your turn, like Lucifer. Like, what kills hope? It almost seemed like she had an answer, but she didn't want to say it, because that would go against like her, I don't know, the rules of hell, or the aim of hell, or whatever. Is you can't go against whatever beats hope, whatever. All in all, I enjoyed it. I thought it was really cool. I mean, when they fight, they're not just going to fucking arm wrestle or play checkers. They're going to do some old otherworldly like showdown. So it was, I don't think they did the best job representing it, but how do you even do that with like this game? I mean, they showed them getting hurt and doing the actual injuries, which I thought was really cool. I assume they actually felt the pain of whatever was happening to them. So it was almost like a test of endurance. To go on a small tangent real quickly, like this scene reminded me a lot of the dice gambling scene from Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. You know, when they're on, it's not the Flying Dutchman, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Whatever. Okay, yeah, so they're on the Flying Dutchman, they're doing the dice scene, and that scene was weird because you don't really know the rules of the game, right? You're kind of watching everything happening, and you don't really get what's going on. I watched a dude do a full breakdown on that scene, and now it's like one of my favorite scenes in cinematic history because they explain the rules, because they explain the motives behind each player and their moves and what they're doing. I felt very similar with this scene right here. Like, I don't really understand the rules. So, you know, when somebody makes a play, I don't exactly know if it's like the best or whatever. I don't know if it's smart. Like, I don't know the rules. Like, could Brienne just start out with Hope? She's like, I'm Hope. And then what do you do? Nothing. Like I'm sure you have to start out low and then build up. But
that's
like
Dave's complaint.
Exactly. Yeah. Paul, you stole the words right out of my mouth. That was exactly my thing. It's like, why not just like become like darkness right away, or, you know?
Yeah. And not give him a chance.
That's the only downside I had about the scene, was that I just wish that we had just gotten explained the rules of what was going on, because I thought the transitions were really badass with how they started off with her saying a direwolf, and then you get the shot of the direwolf and how each thing that they mentioned was interacting with one another. I thought it was really well done, but I was just so confused by the end. And I'm just like, the same thing, Paul. I was like, why not just say Hope right off the bat? Does it have to be like a direct counter to what you're like being offered against, you know, kind of thing? It definitely seemed like a chess match, and I like the idea of it actually affecting them, but it was just so confusing for me first time around.
I will give it to you. It's a little bit weird, but my two counterpoints, and one being what you guys are saying, is the rules. No, we weren't ever clarified. We don't know what you can do and not. Like, maybe you can start with anti-life, and it's like, okay, well, fuck. Mm-hmm. But another part is, I kind of took it like similar to an anime fight, where, to use Dragon Ball Z as just a basic example, like in New Age Dragon Ball Z, Goku doesn't just walk right up without kind of testing it out a little bit. You go to Super Saiyan 1, then 2, then 3. You don't just start on Super Saiyan God. Or like for Luffy, you're not just going to come out against the first villain you see and go Gear 5 right away. Like, you kind of work your way up. I don't know.
I just hope
I thought it was just awesome, because I was just sitting there like, what's he going to do next? How's he going to counter that? Like, fuck.
I thought it was a really cool aspect of how the monarchs settle disputes. That seems like one of the go-to.
Yeah. So after that happens, of course, we get Lucifer conceding, and then Mazakeen actually kills the freaking stupid ass demon. What, you thought you were going to get away with picking Lucifer as your champion? Lucifer losing, and then you're not going to have to pay the debt? Like, go fuck yourself, you fucking dude.
He's like holding it too. He's like, this is mine. Yeah. Shut up.
Dies. So that's the end of that. And then we get this cool conversation between Dream and Lucifer, where Dream, always being the respectful endless, says, thank you, Lightbringer. The ruler of hell is honorable indeed. And that's when she puts on a switch, which I wish she kind of didn't do, because she's just like, I'm not, do you understand what's going on here? Like, I'm not honorable. Go fuck yourself. We're going to fight one day, and I'm going to kill you at some point. I'm going to take your realm, basically.
Yeah. She even says, like, the billion lords of hell stand between you. Like, why should we let you leave? Mm-hmm.
And she says, you have no power here. Dreams have no power. And he's got a good comeback for that. He's just like, go ahead.
I was going to say, this might arguably be the best line out of the two episodes, because she's like, you have no power. And his little monologue was so nice. He was like, you say I have no power. You speak truly. But to say dreams have no power in hell, tell me, Lucifer Morningstar, what power would hell have if those imprisoned here were not able to dream of heaven? Mm-hmm. And she's like, you know, one day I'm going to kill you. And that's my response.
new realm confirmed, which we kind of figured with the god drops.
Anyway. Yeah, if there's hell, well, heaven.
Yeah, and that's also like a two for one there, because that's applicable to everybody who's undergoing damnation in hell, but also Lucifer slash Samael, always just looking back up to what if I didn't become Lucifer and was still like God's pure number two angel.
I didn't even like think about that.
Yeah.
It's if definitely you couldn't
hope of heaven, which, yeah. And then it goes right to her and she's like, fuck that. That was a good one. Dream. Get the hell out of here. Which is where she's like, I'm going to kill you one day. Ooh.
Yeah. It's so good. It's exactly what you're saying. It's like a double sided backhanded slap, because not only it was like, no, you're wrong, dreams are in hell, but the dream in hell is everybody's dreaming of fucking leaving in hell because it sucks so much. That's your realm. Your realm is with a bunch of people that don't want to be here.
Yeah. I'm praying that I'm praying that we don't have a Brienne death at the like finale. Like I want Lucifer to make it through season two at least.
Lucifer death.
Like, no, I don't know if
that's gonna kill that.
Yeah, yeah, true.
It's too big of a Brianna Tarth here. Come on.
True. All right. So and let's get to this final. Okay, you got something else?
Yeah, I was gonna say the most badass moment. Probably. Well,
so we're gonna take it from this most badass moment, leaving hell, all the way through the end, which includes we're gonna bring John back into this, the whole warehouse thing. And it starts with Dream using the fucking mask that he got back. Dude, this is so cool. We'll comment on this in a second. You guys can take it away. But he uses the mask to find where the Ruby's location is, teleports back to the warehouse, gets rejected by the Ruby because of John's tinkering with it. John shows up, takes it, and then gives Rosemary the amulet of protection. And then that will close us out for the episode. So final comments here. Let's get it.
Dude, I have chills just thinking about him just turning with the mask on and it's all red, the sand swirl. Dude, that was so fucking hot. I was like, this is what Moon Knight missed out on, man. When Moon Knight didn't have him donning on the cape every like or the mask every time, it's like, come on, man. This is so cool. This is like we haven't seen him have the helm and the sands in like a few episodes. And it was just so badass to see him now that we know more about him and his powers. It was just so satisfying.
He just looked so badass. Him just holding his helm, walking out, like smiling, smirking, like, yeah, I just fucking beat Lucifer in a battle of wits. What of it?
Yeah.
It was just badass. And Matthew's like, can you even see in that thing? He's like, yes, I see it. I see the ruby. I assume he sees like whatever he wants to see in that bad bitch.
And yeah, that's got to be the power of it.
Yeah, and I mean, things start to happen really quick. He's like, I got the helm, I got my Sam, I'm going to go 3 for 3, get this ruby. Yeah. He shows up at the warehouse, and something's wrong. This has been tampered with, and that's all he has time to get out before he's like flung away. And I kind of don't like that this knocked him unconscious. I also don't like that was he still in there unconscious when John came in? That seems a little, what the hell?
He woke up as John was literally like 5 feet away from leaving the warehouse too.
This actually bothered me because the scene continuity of where he got thrown changed in between scenes. Kind of bothered me. So he's like walking up to where the box is. He says it's been tampered with, gets thrown directly backwards. But then when John walks in, Dream is actually like behind another shelf. So he's like, instead of getting thrown backwards, he got thrown backwards and to the right. And it's like, that's not what we saw. It's not what happened. Like, why didn't you just show John seeing him not caring, getting the ruby and walking out?
Yeah, I agree that it rubbed me the wrong way. There were a couple things I was like that, like explain it more, do better.
Yeah,
but they didn't. And I don't really care because they just had to get John away from that ruby and do it without what's his face seeing. But now he knows the ruby's been tampered with, which was also important for him to find out.
Oh, this John moment was so cool too. I honestly was really expecting him to just kill Rosemary here. And the fact that he gives the protection amulet to her, I love that. I love that aspect of John being kind of a sympathetic villain in a sense. Like if you are a good person, John will absolutely have respect for you and, you know, not go out of his way to kill you. I think he's just a very interesting villain. I think that just emphasizes everything I've been saying earlier with just how unique he is, and his acting has been phenomenal. And I literally can't wait to get more of him in the upcoming episodes.
And also, if it does turn out that the Sarah thing isn't a coincidence, where Rosemary's daughter,
it can't be now that she has the.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like it could totally come into play with Joanna's ex and like link them all together.
It's got it. You got me sold on that. Absolutely.
Yeah. But I'm at the same time. I feel like it's so. I don't even think it's tinfoily, but it's almost at the, to me, it feels like it could be a coincidence, which I would hate, but
it's so perfectly lined.
I'm hoping it's not. Common name.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, it doesn't have to be a thing.
But she could give the amulet cool. to Sarah, and then it comes back to Joanna. Like, oh my God.
If it is a thing, we've talked about it and nailed it on the pod, and I feel proud about that. I also have to say, I can't believe it took this long, but Rosemary is the psychiatrist in season 2 of Ted Lasso, and who will be a recurring character going forward. Mm. Either of you watched Ted Lasso?
I don't have Apple TV, but crazy, as soon as I get
it's good stuff. Paul, you'd for sure love it. But yeah, she's great in that.
West Ham? Doing
a job in this, for sure.
West Ham's in it, I heard. West Ham is rubbish. What the fuck's...
Confirmed.
No. What is wrong with Rosemary, dude? Why at the end is she like, I know I'm going to regret this, but do you need a ride somewhere? Like, is she just trying to keep tabs on him so she knows where to tell the police to go? Does she think, like, okay, he's a good person? I know he did, like, exploded that guy at the gas station, but, like, maybe that wasn't his fault because I saw that supernatural shit happen. She's like, fuck it. I'm just going to go with it.
Maybe she's like, just kind of thinking that if she saw what he's capable of with blowing people up, maybe she was thinking if she did just like ditch him here, he would come after her and kill her.
I was thinking that too. Dude. Still looking out for herself. Like, also, I don't want to ditch this guy.
It could be, it was hinted at that, the vestments can help you manipulate people too. So the fact that when he comes back with the ruby, he could like have influence over her to just help him. Like anybody around him is going to want to help.
I was getting that vibe too, because it was like her tone very much changed from being scared to more just
manipulated calm.
Yeah. It felt like she was being controlled almost by something.
So, and so that was, that even adds more weight to the fact that John doesn't abuse that and lets her go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, good for John. He said it. He said what I was thinking when he walks out and has the ruby, goes to her window and he's like, why are you still here? And I'm like, that's what I'm thinking. Why are you still here? Get out of there. And she's like, are you going to kill me? And I'm like, you could have driven away and not just wondered and pondered that question. So I don't know. I'm going to go off of what you said, that the vestments just slowly controlling weak minds around them.
Either way, I'm going to take my final opinion here of these two episodes. I said it 100 times throughout this podcast. Like, I'm fucking unbelievably in. And Brian, I think you texted us, I think it's episode 6 that's considered the best of the season from a critic standpoint, and I'm really excited for us to cover it, because I've seen even people that love the Sandman show highlighting episode 6 on Twitter. Like, I'm expecting a lot for our next podcast, so I'm really excited, because 4 for 4 in my mind, one of the strongest 4 episode starts of a fantasy series of all time, and I'm pretty confident about that opinion, like, of my own board. But
I will say, as someone who doesn't know either of the source materials, this was a better quality first 4 than Wheel of Time was. It just is.
I would agree with that. Absolutely.
So you're going to say Witcher, which I might agree with. But
no, I would agree with that too.
Yeah.
But season, like, if we're saying season 2 of The Witcher, like, I just loved season. Sorry, we're getting totally sidetracked. The first 4 episodes of The Witcher weren't like amazing, like, you know.
First 4 of this, though.
Yeah, first 4 of this, though, has been amazing.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Like, if this is only the intro episodes, how good is it going to be when it gets to the climax of what it's been building towards in, like, season 2?
Mm-hmm. As long as they don't fumble the bag, like certain shows, GOT. Would it be a total coincidence if this show fumbled the bag and Brienne was on both shows?
And Tywin.
That would just ruin her career.
And Tywin.
Oh, and Tywin. Their careers are ruined.
All the Game of Thrones actors get blacklisted. Yeah.
No, we have high hopes for the show, and I feel like because their source material that's completed, like, they're just, there's no way for them to fuck this up.
I love it.
We got any last words from anybody?
Nah, bro. Let's get our next endless meet next episode and bring Joanna back.
Yeah, get us out of here, bruv.
Agreed. All right. That's going to be our episode 3 and 4 coverage of Netflix's The Sandman. I think we're going to continue with this 2 episode per podcast format, and we're going to do it season long. So you can expect more episodes of The Sandman coming up soon. As always, if you like what you heard, give Bingetown TV a follow on Twitter and Instagram, pretty much all our socials. I would say visit us on bingetowntv.com. That has all our links to all of our episodes, other shows that we cover, all of our social media links, etc. And the number one thing that you can do to support us for free, in my opinion, is just click subscribe on our YouTube channel, all of our socials, give us a follow, subscribe to our show, Apple Podcasts. That is the best way that you can support us for free. And I implore you to do so. So thank you for listening. Once again, we are Bingetown TV. And I always do this, so I have to say it again. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.